Welcome to the Movie Vault. I'm Ben.
And I'm Zach.
And today we venture into the wonderful world of beauty and cosmetic surgery, which is truly something that we have not really delved into yet. And
well,
it's exciting.
Have I told you that I'm going to be a plastic surgeon one day?
Really? This is a new development that I did not know about. He gets into medical school and immediately he's like, okay, that's not enough. I need to pick the hardest residency to get into.
This
and the most profitable one.
Movie showed me just the benefits of plastic surgery, especially face transplants.
Yes, which was a very new technology in 1961 when the movie that we reviewed came out. In fact, it was so new that I don't think one had probably been successfully done at this point. But I'm just guessing.
No, I don't.
I wonder if they had attempted. Do you think they had attempted by this point?
Well, I mean, people would cut off people's faces.
Because they do. Have they done head transplants?
Is that a...
I feel like I've heard rumors of that. That's like they keep... I don't know. No, they can't.
I don't know if that would ever work.
No, they haven't done head transplants. I'm making that up. They have. There's probably been something where they were like, they did something crazy, but it was not a head transplant, and it definitely wasn't successful. But face transplant, I think they've probably done that.
Mm-hmm. It's inspired me.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, and in what way?
I don't know. I just... The look on his face, cutting her face open, he looked happy.
I mean, he was making some people happy. That's for sure.
Sure.
He was making other people not as happy.
He did it for his wife. That's what I've been told.
Right. Which is, I mean, we're just around a wedding, and mm-hmm. at weddings you make all these vows, and one of them is that if your wife wants a new face...
You give her one.
Or somebody else to have a new face, you give her one, right? Mm-hmm. That's it, right in there.
You're supposed to give her the face off your back.
Yep. Absolutely. And you may be wondering what movie we could be talking about, and it's... Les yeux sans visage, which in English is eyes without a face. For all our French listeners, just pretend that I pronounced that right.
But there was a dubbed version called The Horror of Chamber of Dr. Faustus.
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. The Horror Chamber of Dr. Faustus. I think Eyes Without a Face is much catchier.
I don't really know. None of it rolls off the tongue.
There's probably like a marketing thing for when... they released it in the U.S. to be like, oh, people are going to love the Horror Chamber. Like, that must have been, like, the theme of...
Like, the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari.
Yeah, there was probably other movies that had names similar to that, so it was just, like, draw in the viewer. But the movie was... it's obviously a French movie. It was based on some sort of book or short story, it looks like, by Jean Redon. It stars Pierre Brossard, Alidia Valli, Juliette Méniel, and a bunch of other French people. Cinematography by Eugene Schuften, who's German, actually. Music by Maurice Jarry. Very good soundtrack, I have to say. Mm-hmm. Very good soundtrack. And it was released in France, so they don't give us any details on the box office, apparently, because that's too hard to figure out, I guess, for people on Wikipedia. Let's see. Initially... French critics were moderate, ranging from mild enthusiasm to general disdain, claiming it to be either a repetition of German expressionism, which we've talked about before, or simply a disappointment of the director's leap from documentary filmmaking to genre filmmaking. So apparently he had been doing documentaries before this, and they liked him doing that better and didn't like him doing this. It is interesting that this movie is also considered to be part of the French New Wave, at least to some degree, because it is not quite like the traditional French New Wave movies due to its nature of being a genre film or kind of like a horror movie.
Tell me what a typical French New Wave would be.
So the French New Wave was a movement that emerged in the late 1950s that was characterized by its rejection of traditional filmmaking conventions in favor of experimentation and a spirit of iconoclasm, which you might not know what that means because I didn't know what it means. And it means the importance of the destructions of icons and other images or monuments frequently for religious or political reasons, which it makes sense with how we know.
So down history, with institutions.
The history of France, right? Like, you don't think of it as a place that is like real reverent towards their...
Well, no, they don't work.
Yeah, and they don't work too, except for at making movies apparently. So people who are important in this movement were François Truffaut, Jean-Luc Godard, Claude Chabat, Jacques Rivet. If you don't know how to pronounce a French person, just like pronounce it the worst way possible. You're probably right. And an important part of French New Wave movies was that was a sort of they feel very true to life, though at least the ones that I've seen. They don't necessarily heavily lean on plot. They lean on characters. And I know like a movie like Breathless, which is considered to be one of Godard's masterpieces, it also featured new kind of camera features like shaky cams and stuff like that. So it was just a lot of like experimenting with things. But I think the thing that Eyes Without a Face has that those movies do not have is their lack of a plot. Like Eyes Without a Face definitely has a plot, but I can see how it is still feels different than like an American horror movie at this time may have looked, I think, because the horror is in something that is not exactly in your face, but is still very scary. Right? Is that fair to say?
Well, yeah.
Like the doctor, he's kind of a weird looking guy. He's kind of clumsy. Sometimes he looks dumb. He's not like a scary monster, but the actions that he does are very intimidating.
There were some interesting artistic choices that were made in this film, such as having weird qualities of some of these characters that could have otherwise been bland and been fine. I mean, none of the relationships in the family were defined at all, and everything. You know what I mean? You're like it's her parents trying to protect her, but why did she get in this situation? And we are meeting this girl after the car crash, right? After what? Mm-hmm. Or what, it was a car crash, right? Is that what he said? Something like that. I can't remember.
A girl at the start of the movie who's in the car crash. She dies. No, you're right.
Yeah, it was a car crash that she got her face
is messed up in it. I'm thinking of somebody else.
Oh.
They killed another girl to make it look like the girl who messed up her face died. That's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
So she was in a car crash. Her face got messed up. She wears a mask, and then they kill this other girl and have a funeral for her as if she was Christiane, I think. Christiane's the main character, Eyes Without a Face. That's her.
Mm-hmm.
And it truly is like her face is so scarred and disheveled that it's like she doesn't have – she just has eyes and a mouth.
Yes. Well, typically, face transplants – are for people who are in that situation, who have been in some kind of traumatic experience that has disfigured them somehow, especially in the facial area, or if they have some kind of parasite or something else up there. We actually had a friend, Ben, that had a parasite in his face. Do you remember him? And it ate like part of his cheek, and then he had to take like the thigh. Remember him?
Mm-hmm.
And yes, they had to put it in his village in Ghana. And it was a crazy surgery. That's like part of a face transplant. So we know someone who's had one. They started in 1600 BC.
Really?
Egyptian medical texts. That. It's called the Edwin Smith Papyrus. Has some face transplant data in there. That's the earliest records we have of face.
Those Egyptians, man, they were pioneers.
They really were.
I think they just did stuff, and so sometimes they figured out things.
Yeah, but I wonder, like, how could they have built things that last longer than the things?
Yeah, the pyramids are a mystery.
Because
The way that they say they made them, you're like, really?
Yeah.
It had to be more complicated than that.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, I have the truth, Ben, but I'm not going to reveal it. You're not going to reveal it,
yeah.
Because these people...
You want to gatekeep that.
These people can't handle the truth.
Of course they can't.
And the world's first partial face transplant happened in 2005 in France, funny enough. And the world's first full transplant was completed in Spain. In 2010. So the Spaniards beat us all. And it's basically replacing someone's face with tissue from some type of donor. And the actual name is vascularized composite tissue allotransplantation, or VCA. And it involves transplantation of like skin, nasal structure types of things, you know, nose, lips, muscles, nerves, and potentially even bones, which would be a pretty hard surgery to perform. Shout out to all the surgeons that we know. We know a couple of them.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to take lifelong medications to avoid rejection. So that is the history of transplants as we know them in the medical system. However, what you see in this film is not at all how a transplant should be done. One, because of HIPAA and ethics and human rights in any form or fashion. But two, after looking at some of these transplants, he didn't even do it correctly, which bothered me a little bit. So In fact, he did not even follow a sterilized, he did not keep everything sterilized, and his hand went below his waist many times.
So in other words, he was a horrible surgeon.
Well, yeah, he probably wasn't even a surgeon. That's the thing. He was probably like a family medicine doctor of the town. It didn't seem like
that's a good point. You're probably right about that. He probably was just a non-surgical physician.
And they probably didn't have that subspecial or the specialty back then. I don't really know when the
medical training system, who knows how it worked in France.
Back then they said drink mercury, that'll fix your typhoid.
Yeah. If you were the family medicine doctor, you were also the surgeon and you got to try whatever surgery you wanted.
Yeah, you delivered babies, perform heart surgeries, everything. You were quite literally in charge of everything, no matter how much malpractice you could do. But that's all they had. What, you know, you got to
It was better than nothing. That's what
I mean, tried to argue. Some of it was better than nothing, you know?
Sometimes it was worse than nothing, though.
Yeah. But yeah, it follows this daughter who is ashamed of her face, but also doesn't like being held captive in society like Fiona from Shrek. And the father is really controlling and honestly a little manipulative to keep his daughter up in this, up in her room and away from society, because it seems like he is also embarrassed of her. And his wife kind of does it. It's kind of like
well,
a nurse.
Okay, right? I'm reading it, and that's actually not his wife. Louise is his assistant who acts as a surrogate mother to Christiane. So he has no wife.
Well, how were you supposed to know that at all?
Well, we weren't. I don't know. That's just what Wikipedia is telling me. But I guess they never really say it is his wife, so...
I didn't check for rings, so...
Yeah, I could see it, but I also do agree it's confusing the way they portrayed it.
Yeah. Well, anyway,
she did seem kind of young to be her actual mother, although she could be a stepmom.
It's France, you know.
The France way.
So they're both kind of like on board to keep her away from people. And they're trying to find her a replacement. So they look for all these pretty women in the town, and they kind of lure them in and invite them for something, you know, some application or something like that. And they come in, trap them. First they drug them, then trap them. And then bring them downstairs into the dungeon and, you know, jigsaw style, cut off their faces and put them on hers and see how it works.
And there's, if I remember correctly, there's two different women. The first one, they cut off her face or they start to or something. And then she, like, wakes up and, like, jumps out the window and dies.
Yeah.
So that's terrible. And the second woman, you get her on the table, and this is the dramatic moment at the end of the movie where, I forget, does he leave the room?
Yeah,
during
so
surgery?
Yes, because then the daughter comes in. And
yeah,
lets
and
her
the daughter
loose.
Comes in and eventually, and she.
Well, it wasn't mid surgery. I think he was done. At least he was good in that part. The face was on her. I thought.
I thought her face wasn't cut off at this point. I can't remember.
Oh, I don't remember.
Here at the Movie Vault, only the best, only the best analysis.
Okay, you keep talking.
But
I'll find
the main, the main. Point that it doesn't matter if her face is on or off is that Christiane eventually kind of reaches this realization that her desire to have a face that is pretty again is not necessarily a bad desire, but the fact that there are people who are being hurt because of her selfishness, essentially. And she is being manipulated by her father, who I think it's more than just... wanting his daughter to be better. I think he actually just has some sort of demented desire to be cutting off faces. I think that's like sort of the underlying thing.
That's what I thought. It's almost like a Walter White syndrome where he's like at the end he did it for himself rather than...
Yeah, I don't think he was actually trying to help her. I'm not saying it was like a fetish, but it's like it's something. It's something messed up in his head.
Well, it could have been a fetish.
It could have been a fetish.
Face cutting.
I guess the fetishes always have to be sexual. Can you have a fetish that's like not sexual?
No.
Okay, that's what a fetish means.
In my
so
mind,
what
like,
is it like if you are cutting off somebody's face and it's a non-sexual thing but you want to do it? What do you call that?
A hobby?
Like, just like or sadism?
I don't know.
I guess it doesn't. Maybe it doesn't matter. It's just evil. But
I don't know.
I guess sometimes you don't have to worry about the
we call
what
it science.
You label evil.
You know, that's what our world would call it. Curiosity and science.
He's being curious. He's experimenting.
Yeah.
And maybe it was, I mean, maybe it was his love of science that was ultimately higher. You know, good scientists and doctors hold themselves to a code of ethics. And it seems like he had no code of ethics. Or he definitely did not have any code of ethics. So if you don't have a code of ethics, you can see how bad things can turn out.
Oh, you're right, Ben. Before he begins surgery on Paulet, the police arrive. However, I was thinking of Edna Gruber, which she ends up dying.
Right, yeah, that's the one who jumps out the window.
Yes. Anyway, she attempts to fall. Yeah, she falls up from an upstairs window. So only the best here at the movie vault. At least we got the information, you know?
Eventually we'll get you the right information.
Well, the good thing that's was one part. Of us was right. So technically, you know, we're fine.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Apparently, over time, this movie has gained a lot more respect, which is probably why it came across our attention, because it now holds a 97% on Rotten Tomatoes compared to its kind of mixed reviews from early French film critics, which just goes to show you sometimes you have to be careful about judging a movie too soon because you don't know how it's going to age, which I have to remind myself of sometime. Although there's certain times that I'm pretty sure I know that the film is not going to age any better than it came out as. But there might be some movies that take you by surprise over the years.
Yeah, that happens all the time where I'll just come back to a film and like it a lot more, even if it's not as good. But you know, this film, I think, was ahead of its time.
That I would probably rate higher if I watched it again now. Bullet Train.
No way.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it maybe was a better movie than I gave it credit for.
I don't think so. You don't we think just so? Watched it a year and a half ago, right?
Yeah, but it's a movie I think about more often than I thought I would.
Why?
Maybe it's because it's the action. And not even the plot. Just like it's a cool action movie. You know, sometimes you need a cool action movie. There's a lot of really bad action movies. So when there's like a kind of good one.
Yeah, but I thought that was a bad action movie.
No, I don't think it was bad.
What did we give it?
I have not. Do we even actually review it?
Or we did.
We did.
It's an episode.
Really?
Yeah.
For some reason, I thought it was just like we just watched it and we never reviewed it.
No, that was the whole point.
Interesting.
Okay, only the best at the movie vault.
We don't even know our own episodes. We'll have to go back and listen to that episode.
Hey, at least one of us was right.
Yeah, very true.
Yeah. But so Roger Ebert actually said, his quote for this was that I have it right here. Sorry, I'm getting it right open. It passes his test because the lack of its story or its actual story riveted him, and there was no sense of conclusion. I thought that was a good point that he made, that yes, it's a story, like you were saying, compared to other French New Wave, but I saw a little bit of French New Wave based on your definition, which
I guess you're right,
because there really isn't any conclusion at all. There's no resolving.
Well, he dies.
Yeah, but there's no resolving.
He's eating my dogs. That's a conclusion.
Okay,
for me.
There's a conclusion of the villain getting hurt, but there's no sense of, like, I don't know. Well, I mean, did he die?
I guess you're right. There's a little bit more structure than other French wave new wave movies, in my opinion. But it still lacks a bit. It still does lack some structure.
I don't think he died.
Well, he got hurt.
That's what I'm saying. Like, this. I guess he didn't even get caught.
You're right. It was just like, oh, the dogs got him. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, is that enough payment? Is that the reparations?
I mean, he gets disfigured, right? Eye for an eye.
Yeah.
I mean, he did kill people, though. So
I don't. I'm just agreeing with Roger Ebert's point that, like, there's a little bit of French New Wave where, like, there isn't a hero coming to save them. There isn't any redemption.
And if you think about something, categorizing something as like French New Wave, the reason that it is that is because there's different variations and experimentations. It's not like you have to follow these rules to be considered a French New Wave.
Sure, movie. But this is breaking rules from 1950s.
So that's what I'm saying. It is a French New Wave movie. Like, maybe even though it doesn't fit what I think of as a French wave New Wave movie right off the bat, that doesn't
mean you can't have a definition in your head. You can't, like, by the
because the definition of it is that it experiments. It
exactly. So you can't not categorize it as a French New Wave. And that way you have to categorize everything as a French New Wave. But luckily it's restricted by 1958 to 1962, I think.
Yeah. Well,
in a general
sense.
This one
says like late 1960s, but yeah, sometime in the 1960s.
Whatever.
And it lists him as the guy who directed it, which we haven't talked about yet, Georges Franju, as a other directors associated with the movement. So he definitely is associated with it. They only list five directors as like the main directors, and then they have the left bank directors, which I don't really even know what left bank means, but I know Agnes Varda is one of them, and I've definitely heard of her. But the other people, I'm like, I don't know who these people are.
Hmm. Who are the five?
The five are Jean-Luc Godard, Eric Rohmer, François Truffaut, Return of the
Cough,
Claude Chabrol, and Jacques Rivette. And then, like, people like Louis Malle and Jean-Pierre Melville, who we are reviewing a movie of his soon, are also associated with the French New Wave. Louis Malle directed one of my very favorite movies, Au Revoir les Enfants, which is definitely absolutely worth your time to watch. But, like, I think some of the movies, some of the directors continue directing well past the movement. So, like, their film style developed even past it. But I guess, you know, Godard is, like, the big one. He made a ton of movies that are associated. Truffaut, The 400 Blows is a big one, and then there's a few other ones. But I feel like Godard is the one who you, like, countless movies. He just directed a bunch of movies, and they're all, like, kind of considered in the French New Wave style. There was also a movie I watched called Cleo from 5 to 7. That's a classic French New Wave movie. And I don't remember who directed that. I feel like it was a woman. It was Agnès Varda. Okay, so she's one of the Left Bank directors. And that was another movie that just stands out to me as, like, this would be a classic piece of French New Wave artur cinema. So what I think we're getting at is that,
well, speak for yourself.
When you label something, there's very few film movements that have sort of the aura that the French New Wave does. Because when you say it, you sound smart. You're like, oh, I like the French New Wave. Oh, that's cool. That's a cool name. But it's a little looser than maybe saying it's a horror movie, you know, or it's a genre, or like picking a genre. It's not exactly a genre of movie.
Yeah, but I'd still say
it's like a style of filmmaking.
It's still a more specific label.
Well, it has to be French.
Sure, yeah. But it's like you could say old Hollywood.
Right.
And that's a wider gap, right?
You're right. That's a wider amount of movies.
That includes more stars, more directors.
Yeah. And that's just say, I guess there is a style of filmmaking that people are referencing when they say old Hollywood. But it's probably a little bit broader.
Even just splitting it up by decade, like films from the 60s, the 70s, the 40s. This is like in the middle of the French New Wave is a split of decades.
And if I'm not misunderstanding the history of the French New Wave, which I've studied briefly, you know, I've never watched a documentary on it or anything, but I think there was a level of self-awareness that the directors had that maybe other directors didn't have. I want to say either Godard or Truffaut. I think Truffaut, it says he wrote an essay in 1954 where he denounced the adaptation of safe literary works into unimaginative films. So there was this sort of like they knew what they were doing. And I want to say Truffaut started out as a film critic before he even became a director. Yeah, François Truffaut was a film critic before he became a filmmaker. So I think that it gave him time to actually develop what he thought about movies before he made them, which is very interesting. I don't know that, you know, Roger Ebert never started a crazy, you know, film career where he had critically acclaimed movies that he made. I don't think he ever even attempted to ever make a movie.
No, he stuck to his craft.
And I think to some degree he became too famous to even attempt to do that. Because as soon as you are a film critic and you make a movie that's bad, you lose all credibility. You can't be a film critic anymore. You literally lose two jobs. You can't be a director. You can't be a film critic. Because nobody's going to listen to a film critic who makes bad movies.
Yeah.
So if you don't make movies, you don't have to run that risk, right?
Yeah.
So I do think it's the self-awareness played into despite it being like experimental and all of that, there was still a very focused goal of the movement. And the directors who are in it knew it, and that changed, and that influenced people like Martin Scorsese and Brian De Palma and the 70s Hollywood era that would bring like the sort of grittier movies to Hollywood.
Yeah.
And eventually people like Quentin Tarantino.
Exactly. I was about to say, like, Pulp Fiction is a great example of this, just reversing and destroying the regular hero's journey plot, putting a villain in the hero's role and a hero in the villain's role, and just telling it out of order as well. I think Reservoir Dogs is another great example of, you know, different structure. Birdman was one that I found. I know we keep bringing it up, Ben, but David Lynch is a great example of this. Just because David Lynch loves French films, and the French New Wave, one of its defining characteristics was not only just a reversal of what we know as a traditional film, but also the rise of existentialism, like you said.
Right.
German expressionism, like the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, right? We talked about that, like, post-World War One, defiance of nationalism, down with this system, you know, we don't believe in institutions, let's just make everything surreal. So the rise of surrealism. Mm-hmm. What was the other one? There were a couple other things, but just this rejection of classical logic, classical thinking, just a way that we would normally process things in film, the way that we've been taught, honestly, in film to process things. Like, there's a beginning that's happy, then the conflict comes to a climax, and then the climax ends with a conclusion. French New Wave destroys that and brings in this existential dread in the middle of it. And honestly, Ben, if you think about a film that has a plot that's like told out of order and you're honestly not connecting with it and it's trying to make you reach, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, it's really making you work sometimes. That automatically brings in existentialism into the film, even without like having to, without making statements of existentialism. It can just bring in, by the very structure of the film,
absolutely,
those ideas.
And it's very interesting you bring up Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, because I'm reading an article on thefilmstage.com, and they go through the history of the French New Wave, but they have a section on the impact of the French New Wave. Mm. And Quentin Tarantino actually dedicated Reservoir Dogs to Jean-Luc Godard.
Whoa.
So it's very on the nose, wow, that you said that. And the dance scene in Pulp Fiction was also influenced by the French New Wave. They write about, obviously, there's references, and it makes sense in Inglourious Basterds, where they're actually in France. Tarantino, who has been referenced ad nauseum on this podcast, is a master of reference, so it's not surprising he references the French New Wave, because he also, yeah, references tons of other movies.
Well, he even gets that from French. If you said it's a rise of these directors that are self-aware, right? And
yeah,
he was so self-aware because he would just implement so many different films into his films, and it was ironic, it was sarcastic, it was just playing, yeah, off of itself.
And it's like an honest assessment. It's not some, I think sometimes directors, everyone is influenced by the movies they watch, but sometimes in not a way that they know that they're being influenced by them. It's sort of more subconscious, whereas this gave rise to film directors who are like, okay, I know what my source material is, and I'm going to make it obvious, but in a artistic way that's not like
Sunset Boulevard and Inland, yeah, Empire. I'm gonna say it again, I have to.
Yeah, there's these homages, there's these, oh, I can see parallels, but it's still a completely different story. Mm-hmm. You don't feel like you're just watching a remake of a movie, which is what Truffaut was arguing against. He was saying, you know, taking a book and turning it into a movie, that's not good enough.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
If you're going to, now it doesn't mean you can't do that. It means, dude, if you're going to do that, you're going to have to figure out a way to do it that is interesting and innovative, which is why I think people who say, oh, you know, I love this book, but they've turned it into a movie, and man, sometimes it can be a valid criticism, that sometimes they just go, oh, you know, it's not like the book.
It never lives up. It
and
never
I'm like,
does.
It can't, and it shouldn't. Because if you're going to adapt a book, which is already a medium that has a lot of value, like, you can read lots of good books. I think Dune's a great example. I've never read the book Dune, but I imagine it's a great book if you get into it.
Well, and we could go down this rabbit trail,
yeah,
like,
and it's
books
and it's
movies.
Written very well. But if you turn it into a movie, you cannot just go verbatim on how they make the book. It just doesn't make sense. It doesn't work.
People think that books and movies are meant for the same purpose. They are meant for different things.
Yeah. Being an inherently visual medium changes what you can do. It makes it easier and harder at the same time.
Because it's also portraying information in a way that you can process quicker, but you're also going to forget quicker because you're not processing it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's another whole side tangent.
Exactly.
I think we don't realize, and you know, we're not talking about this film as much anymore. Really, we've covered most of this film, and we don't know enough about the director to kind of go deeper. But what I'm saying is, this film is, again, a representative. We pick these films to represent things. This film is representative of this new idea of filmmaking that has actually influenced us in way more ways than we think. Not just Reservoir Dogs, not just Pulp Fiction, but your everyday Minions or everyday, I don't know, Kung Fu Panda, that has a scene in it that's like, doo-doo-doo, doo-doo-doo, and they're like, you know what I mean? Like, they're, yeah, referencing, true, old films in these films because they know that they can build on previous IP and make that connection to make us laugh, to make us reminisce and have nostalgia. That's why all these Marvel movies are coming back with characters from the old films, is because they've learned that references work. They've learned that being aware, self-aware works, except for She-Hulk. If you're going to speak to the fourth wall, do it well. So that French New Wave broke that maybe third wall in a way, because it's using other films, other genres, mixing them. And the culmination of that is David Lynch. He's our golden boy, as always. But I think even in just like pop culture, it's really made a difference.
Yeah, like getting into surrealism, that is one thing that like your traditional French New Wave movies will not have, is that sort of surrealist element. And I'm very excited that we'll get to see some of that next episode with 8.5, which dives a lot into surrealism and get into some Italian cinema. But it is interesting to follow the trajectory of movies and then to realize how interconnected everything is. I mean, that's really the purpose of this podcast, right? I feel like we've discovered over time is finding these connections in our weird, twisted sort of way, where we're bouncing all around history and just starting to understand film by film
life
and themes and ideas. How thoughts are portrayed in pictures and in stories, and what we can learn and what truth we can pull from each movie, and what falsehoods we can pull from each movie, and what things work and what things don't work. Like, I think our if we were to just give a candid review of this movie, I think we both gave it 3.5 stars. Mm-hmm. And it is a good movie in the sense that it was interesting, it held your attention, but it didn't seem to be a movie that pushed so far into new ideas that I was really enthralled by it.
No, but it was in that, you know, I can use the term wave. It really was. It was a part of that collection, and it stands out. It's famous because it stands out. Because
it does.
There were some pre-Cronenbergisms in this.
Yeah. Oh, that's something that I'm glad you brought up. Because this movie definitely has aspects of body horror that I think were probably at the very beginning of evolving at this point. I'm sure there was some weird country and weird director that had made movies that were just like messed up and weren't as popular. But this made it, but in an era where people were still kind of, the line hadn't been pushed all that far, definitely not in the US, at least in movies that, you know,
we're still traditional folk, because
there was
over
the
here.
Hays Code in the U.S. still at this point. In France, I'm sure they had different rules, but they kind of they didn't quite, you know, go to the level that Cronenberg would go to in the 80s, in the 70s and 80s, with his crazy sort of messed up surrealist imaginations, and just even watching like movies like his more recent ones like Crimes of the Future, where it's just like surgery is sex and they are, you know, doing these crazy things. Like they are, it's kind of interesting now that I think about it. I'm speaking a million miles a minute because I'm starting to make these connections. Like Crimes of the Future is that you can almost link it back to Eyes Without a Face, because it's about people who are like, I guess, more consensually performing surgery, but it deals with like ethical dilemmas of like, should you be allowed to do this?
Yeah.
And it gets to points where they're doing things that are not ethical. Well, I don't even remember everything.
I love that, like, it bring, like, this Eyes Without a Face also brings up an ethical question. Should this be allowed? And the answer is pretty clear as well. You know, sometimes the answers aren't supposed to be unclear.
Yeah.
It's not fully realized French New Wave, maybe, but in the ethical sense. But I think you're right. Yeah. I mean, even just like, even his older films like The Fly, Videodrome, stuff like that, where people are growing body parts out of different areas that they shouldn't be, and people are morphing into different things. And this really started it, because, I mean, they're cutting off faces. You get to see all the blood and all the stuff behind them. And there's a lot of blood in this film, and it was kind of gross. Some of this stuff was like, oh, I don't like that. You know, seeing a knife to skin without, you know what I mean? Like in films.
And without the
camera cutting away.
It's surgery, but it's surgery done wrong. Is also difficult.
Well, it's not surgery then. That's just mutilation.
Yeah, it's mutilation.
Surgery is precise. It's pragmatic. I mean, I don't know. Pragmatic is not a great word to use.
But it's sterile. You know, it's
sure. Yeah, it's a plan. Exact. I mean, that's plan two. Maybe I should find better words to use. Surgery is something else. It's something different. But anyway, yeah. So I think that the Cronenbergisms were maybe my favorite part of the film, and I think it was the strength, definitely. It honestly caught me off guard. I have not seen many French films, and to see a film even from 1960 go that far with some of the gore, for it to be this popular, I think that's why, actually, it's gained in popularity after its time. You know what I mean? Where we are more desensitized to things and can, we like these things. We're drawn to blood. We are bloodthirsty, Ben.
Yeah. It's like, this was happened to me more when I was younger in my watching movies career, but
you say
there's
career.
Things that you like don't want to see, but you do want to see at the same time. And because of like human curiosity. So like,
yeah,
now I'm
curiosity.
A little bit more desensitized to violence in movies, but back then it was like, oh, I want to turn away, but then also I kind of want to see this. I want to watch movies like Saw and Hostel, and like they're drilling through people and it's crazy, and it's there's like you're like, what is the like the point of the movie is that something bad is happening to somebody, mm-hmm. and there's not really a redeeming quality. Like maybe they set it up so that this is like a consequence of their actions, but it always seems like blown out of proportion. And then you're like, why am I watching this? Am I watching this because I like violence? I hope not. I hope that's not why you're watching it. But some movies you do have to question. You're like, maybe this isn't an edifying use of my time.
This is a good idea, because sometimes you think, or sometimes you wonder why you're watching a film, but it's like, if you're watching it for the first time, you don't really know what you're getting into sometimes.
That's a good point.
So like when somebody recommends you a film, or you hear how great a film is, or if there's just a legendary film that's gone down in history and you start watching it and it's about killing people and you're like, this is disgusting. It's not your fault always.
No.
You can choose to quit.
Sometimes you should probably have a good idea though, based on reputation sure. of certain movies.
And I think this is a good thing that I need to work on. Don't be afraid to stop halfway through. I'm so yeah. OCD about finishing films.
You're right. I am too. Sometimes it would probably be more. There might be a few movies that I have stopped halfway through.
Because of boredom or just
no,
grossness?
Because of grossness.
Oh.
Yeah. Hmm. But not more often than not, I just finish it.
Yeah.
But I also, they haven't been like the necessarily the true offenders of, I'm not even going to mention the movies that I'm thinking of, because they have a reputation. People know about them. And I've heard about what they're about. But I would never watch them because I think everyone should have a line. I think you should have a line. It's okay if your line is not as far as ours, certainly.
It's probably better if it's not as far as
yeah,
ours.
Probably better. It probably shouldn't be much further.
Yeah. I think we're right at the maximum.
Yeah, I would say so, because there are certain movies that, like I said, I'm thinking of them like just out of pure and I just don't think – I know some of them are supposed to be making these, like, satirical statements and yeah. stuff like that, but I don't – I think satire has a line, and all these things have a line, you yeah. know. At some point, you do have to have limits, so that is a good thing. I think it's – the censorship debates get complicated, and how people are like, well, should this be allowed? I think some movies that push that line were maybe criticizing censorship, and that's why the movies exist in the first place. Mm,
yeah.
But – you should self-censor is what I would say. You should definitely use your freedom and
self-control.
Self-censor. Have self-control, yeah.
Mm. Preach, Ben. That's great. Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that we would be talking about that. Maybe we'll close it out by following it up on Georges Franju a little bit, because this guy is an interesting fella. He started with a series of 9 documentary movies, and he focused on the Nazi occupation of Paris and industrialism following World War II.
Oh, not that.
So that was, and his first documentary is called The Blood of Beasts, and it's about a graphic film about killing animals. So, you know, French or filmmakers love that. They love slaughterhouses. And then there was something about the celebration of the modernizing of French industry.
And there's one about a veterans hospital, I see.
Oh, it was commissioned to say that the modernization of French industry was good, but then Franju made it show how bad it was.
Wow.
So he actually got paid, and then he ripped on the people that paid it. That's amazing. Actually kind of funny. It shows you the kind of person he is. So this was actually his second feature film, Eyes Without a Face. He also had Head Against the Wall, which I don't know. Let's see, Head Against the Wall. It's his first fiction movie, yeah. And so then he would focus on fiction movies. And he made a decent amount of. He used elements of surrealism and shock horror, which I guess I wouldn't think of this movie as being surreal, but maybe if you consider the whole thing being surreal. Like, there's not like a in and out.
But fever dreamish.
You could say, this is a crazy story. Like, would somebody be wearing that mask? Like, there's things that don't make sense.
Yeah.
So maybe, and that.
It's very contained and unrealistic.
Yeah.
Fever dreamish.
I think when I think surreal, I think of movies that have like some level of like, this is reality and this is not reality. Mm-hmm. Or like David Lynch, where it's like all not reality, but it still is so weird that you're.
David Lynch is constantly teasing.
But there's still like levels. It's like, this feels more real and this feels more like.
Listen, dream. David Lynch is the most organized surrealist I've ever known.
That's yeah, but thing. In a like really a way that somehow still feels natural.
Yeah.
That's so impressive.
Yeah. He did Judex, which was a tribute to silent films.
Ooh, mm-hmm. Interesting. Maybe this would be an interesting guy to get into. I feel like he had an interesting takes on things. But by far, this movie is his magnum opus.
Yeah.
Is what the consensus is.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, it's great. I'm not saying it's not good. I just think we picked a good one to represent a larger topic of filmmaking.
And I hope at some point we will get more into some of the other big hitters in the French New Wave. Like, particularly my favorite one is Breathless. I think it's a fantastic movie. Definitely is in my top 50. And I would love to watch it again just to get another read on what I think of it.
Maybe we'll look into the Left Bank film directors.
Yeah, that too. Yeah, that'd be cool. Yeah. That'd be cool.
Yeah. Well, that's all I got, Ben. That's the end of my notes.
That's all I got, too.
Oh, you're done.
I got nothing else.
Okay. Well, do you have any movie highlights from the last week?
I do. So I finished watching the Italian movie Bicycle Thieves. Mm. Zach was commenting he thought I gave it too low of a rating, 3.5. He hasn't watched it yet, though. It is rated very highly on Letterboxd. One thing I will say, I watched it over multiple viewings or multiple sittings, which is never the way that you should watch movies. So I think maybe a more focused viewing would help me have a better, more cohesive perspective on the movie. But it was well directed. Loved the characters. It staged economic struggle at that point in Italian history, which I'm very unfamiliar with, in a way that I could easily understand. And I didn't realize how important bicycles were to people until I watched this movie. Mm. So that's what I would say.
Yeah, very important, Ben.
Because cyclists I know are kind of like pretentious, other than one particular cyclist with that we both hair. Know with red hair that we both know and love. he's not annoying at all, no, but there's some not. Other cyclists who are.
I love that I knew that right away.
Yeah.
I've just watched David Lynch's Straight Story. I have 10 minutes left. I'll throw it in here, though.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Who directed this? I mean, it's crazy how it's so heartfelt. It's just this guy who's going across to see his brother after he has a stroke to reconcile with him. And he meets a bunch of people along the way, and he's a sweet old man who gives great advice to everyone he meets and tries to resolve their life issues and teach them a lesson. And it's so sweet. It's a Disney film, of all things. David Lynch made a Disney film that Sean Fennessy gave 4.5 stars on Letterboxd.
I need to watch this movie.
This exists, Ben.
I know it does.
It exists.
And it's one of his last feature films.
Yeah, it's 1999.
Yeah.
2 years before Mulholland Drive.
Wait, really? For some reason, I thought it was after Mulholland Drive. It's before. No. That's cool.
So this is his third to last film.
That's crazy.
So listen, then it goes a Straight Story, which Straight is a perfect. I mean, the guy's last name is Straight. That's why it's called the Straight Story. But it makes sense because like this is his most straightforward film that he's ever made. This like it makes sense. It has a
even
linear
more than
plot.
Elephant Man, that which I haven't seen.
Yes, it's much more simpler than Elephant Man. Elephant Man is also pretty good. Elephant Man's a little bit more dreadful and has some existentialism in it. This is heartfelt and Disney themed, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And then it goes straight into Mulholland Drive and an Inland Empire to finish it out. It's just like he had to get this out of the way before he just barfed out his soul.
Right. So, right.
Very good. Recommend it. I'll probably give it 4 stars.
I was going to talk about Fire Walk With Me. I never remembered that we watched it before we reviewed the movie last week. So.
I was about to say that, yeah.
Oh, bummer. We'll have to. I just. It's still,
we'll review
it's,
it one
I'm
day.
Still thinking about it.
Yeah, me too.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
Definitely. We could not more highly recommend Twin Peaks. We watched the first episode of The Return together,
mm-hmm.
And I'm looking forward to finishing it.
I have no idea what's happening.
No, The Return is crazy so far. It's absolutely insane.
Just new stuff everywhere. And it's funny seeing old Jerry and old Ben.
Yeah, and all the old characters. And I'm sure we'll get introduced to more as time goes on. So I'm excited.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
And, was it Dale Cooper, Kyle MacLachlan, doesn't look a day after he left Twin Peaks season two.
Yep, not even
a day
a
older,
bit.
I mean, I said after.
Ageless face.
Mm-hmm.
All right, shall we close the vault?
Sure. Yeah, cheers.
Cheers. Clink, clink.
That's from Despicable Me, the first one.